You know, he's really shameless in intellectual argument. He's absolutely without character, a moral foundation, or even intellectual substance.
Welcome back to the Getting Lit podcast. Last episode, we finished our series on Gene Wolfe, Book of the New Sun, with the Agitator Boys. And this episode, we are talking about The Valley of the Dolls, a novel by Jacqueline Suzanne. And we're also talking about some movie adaptations, the original 1967, I think it is, movie adaptation, and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, a 1970, I would say, spiritual sequel to the book. And to join me on this journey is a wonderful podcaster and thinker. Who is named Jack Mason. Welcome, Jack.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. You are the host of one of my favorite podcasts, which is The Perfume Nationalist. If you haven't listened to it, go and listen to it right now. Not right now. Listen to us first. But yes, how would you describe, for anyone who's not aware, how would you describe your podcast? I always like to get people's pitch for like what they, how they would describe it.
Ooh, I haven't had to do the pitch for it in a long time. I pair perfumes throughout history with relevant media of different kinds, movies, books, TV shows, sometimes video games. I have a preoccupation with soap opera that runs throughout the show. I talk about perfume a lot and read a lot of books, basically, and I've been doing it for almost 5 years at this point.
Wow, 5 years. Yeah, perfume and books, it's a perfect combination as far as I'm concerned. I've been listening to it for a while. I've always wanted to ask you, actually, like, how this pairing process comes about. Is it you get the inspiration from the perfume first and that directs you towards the media, or is it vice versa, or a combination of the two? Or
At this point, it's usually I think of the media and then I think of a perfume to pair it with, because at this point I've covered most of the big famous perfumes that I'm most interested in, but I still keep thinking of ones that are really obvious that I haven't covered yet. It can be paired with the media for different reasons. I mean, the chronological timeline resonance, the general style, the tone of the perfume, what the creator is like. I guess usually it's about time period, but not always. The most synchronous pairing I ever did that worked the best was Jean Patou Joy with Gone with the Wind at the end of 2020, the first COVID year. And Joy had been discontinued to make a really anonymous, stupid Dior perfume. And the world had been ended with like COVID and rigged elections and wokeness and all of this. So I thought it worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm. But I went on your show for an episode on the films of Todd Haynes, which I had a lot of fun, and you paired that with Diarella. Yeah, I have to thank you for that, because like that's in my rotation now. I love it. Like, it's so melony and grassy, and I kind of wear it. I'm wearing it a lot now because it's spring here, so I'm just like,
oh, beautiful,
frolicking around, smelling like a big rolling lemon.
Well, there's a lot more to get into if you're into that. Mm-hmm. I love that episode. That episode turned out really, really good. I feel like the reputation of Todd Haynes has dwindled over the years because of his strange fizzling out career choices, but he's extremely important to me and was extremely important to gays like us of a certain age, when his filmography was just like rock solid hits, say Velvet Goldmine and everything. So
banger after banger. Really, yeah, he's one of my favorites, and like one of the reasons I kind of like really am inspired and sort of vibe with your podcast is that we are on the same wavelength with those sorts of films, not just the gay films, but like, you know, every time you talk about a film and like this random gay film or something, I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen that. I love that. And we kind of think the same about them. Like Haynes is so funny because he is not a quote unquote gay filmmaker, if you know what I mean. Like it's not like, I don't know, AIDS movies, TV movies and stuff like that, people dying of AIDS and it's a big tragedy and stuff like that. He's more of sort of, it's more a punk sensibility, right? And like, it's just, it really goes there with a lot of the violence. It's very eroticized. It does it in a way that's not like respectable gay media, you know, and that's what I've always really kind of loved about him.
Well, it's hard to imagine that there was a time when the word queer did not mean total monolithic authoritarian conformity of the lowest common denominator. But yeah, he was one of the big new queer cinema directors in the early 90s, and all those movies were like, we're showing gays being bad instead of educational sob stories about how they're actually good. So, you know, Poison is about like hot prison rape and how gays are diseased, and Swoon
pus,
was about
pus melting off their face.
Yeah, pus melting off their faces, and Swoon was about gay serial killers, and yeah, there were it was a cool moment. But yeah, that word. The Q word
yeah.
Means something totally different now.
It means like disconnected purple hair cut, basically. That's what that means.
It just means a Democrat. It just means an uncreative Democrat authoritarian who stands for nothing.
Pretty much, yeah. So I also wanted to talk about you do you say you do media, so films are music, and you also do a lot of books, and you have been doing a lot of books recently, which I've loved. Like you do those book clubs, which are really fun to listen to. Where do you think we are with the state of reading? Because I agonize over this all the time, having like a books based sort of podcast, where I'm like, am I just talking? I'm just screaming into a void about reading, but I still do it because I think it's really important to read fiction, especially. Where do you stand on this? Because no one reads anymore.
Yeah, no one reads anymore. There's been this like midwit trope where people think it's sophisticated to say you don't read fiction, which I trace back to 2000s AP History, Daily Show, Supersize Me, Bowling for Columbine Libs. That's where I first saw it. And those people are still very much around. Generally, no one reads anything. I think reading fiction is really important because after the kind of Harry Potter apocalypse, I was just talking about this with the group chat earlier today. Harry Potter really ended people reading books for grownups. This isn't like a unique point, but it did. And before that, it was like kind of a common sight to see people reading literary fiction for adults or like a classic. Now you basically never see that. There's this kind of niche literati scene on Twitter that makes things worse by lying about reading. They scan their eyes over PDFs and like pretend that they're still moving around in this world where everybody's familiar with all these classics, when really no one's read almost anything. And I don't even know what they assign kids to read in school. I'm sure it's nothing that I was assigned, because all of that's been deemed problematic. If I have any message for my podcast, I mean, it's the greatness of reading, because I'm really one of those like Mary Englebright, like too many books, too little time bookstore ladies from before those were corrupted by woke politics into having like Obama candles and stuff. But originally in the 90s, when it was just about like drinking Celestial Seasonings tea and constantly thinking about books, that's me. I've seen palpable results of people, like many, many people who listen to my podcast reading books that I talk about. So I guess I'm doing my part. They all buy Scruples. As the book clubs that you mentioned have been really successful. I don't see anyone else talking about Samuel Richardson these days.
Samuel Delaney.
Yeah. I'm probably the only person selling copies of Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders. I'm selling everyone's books, but it does. I'm a Republican, so it's like I don't exist. But yeah, I'm sure 90-year-old Samuel Delaney noticed an uptick in sales of his 800-page N-word-filled gay incest fantasy, Through Booga. The Valley of the Nest of Spiders, which is one of my favorite books.
Booger fetish books.
Booger fetish, father-son utopia, trash dump porno book.
That is such a great book. And that is like one of my favorite episodes that you did too, because basically you sissy hypnoed a bunch of straight guys into reading basically what you just described, like a really pornographic. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't even like a big task for them. Yeah, it was like a big gangbang. There's so many people in that episode. Three straight guys read that book and one girl. I was very happy about it. And also, you know, I always encourage people to listen to my podcast start to finish in order to get the full story, because you really miss out if you're a person who just dips into things to hear celebrities or whoever. But that played an important part, because before leftists became aware of me, my original audience during season one was like just alt-right people. Just considered like scum of the earth, domestic terrorists. I hadn't been like normalized to anyone yet. So that episode was like a big fuck you to anyone who had tried to impose their Puritan morals on me or what. I can't remember now, it was so long ago, what and things have changed so much, but yeah, it meant a lot at that point. And I expected this big like outcry, but no one cared because it's a book. And you know, it's like
when I did
The Fountainhead, people were mad about that. The Lady Gaga one, people were mad about that, obviously. But yeah, I was like, oh, people are going to be so mad about that I'm endorsing this black interracial gay incest porno booger book. No one cared. So.
Yeah, because you would have to read the 800-page
You would have to know whereas people see the word Ayn Rand and just instantly their emotions start fluctuating. So.
Mm. Yeah, I think I haven't read. I've read Anthem. I've got to read Fountainhead next, I think.
You've got to read all of them.
I do, yeah. Funny point about Fountainhead. I think I've told you this actually, but I had this sense that your show is like secretly super influential. Like, and I'm not gassing you up here, but I'm just like, I've just noticed things. Like, I remember when you did the episode with Alec on the Fountainhead. And then like a year later, all of these people in like literary scenes that I'm sort of tangentially sort of connected to just through friends mostly, everyone was suddenly reading The Fountainhead. And like, yep. I know for a fact that they don't listen to podcasts and they probably don't listen to yours because they don't listen to podcasts. I'm like, it feels like it just trickled out probably via like various sort of networks like Red Scare and things like that.
It's
interesting.
True. I do all kinds of that shit. Like, nobody's talking about Scruples, but the important thing is that you receive the information second or third hand and don't give any credit to me because I'm a a bad right winger and I'm whiny and hysterical online or whatever, you know, like, so the important thing is giving no credit to me, but you still get all of my wonderful recommendations and can appropriate them as if they had come to you from someone else. But mm-hmm. yeah, I see that kind of thing all the time. And I see it with the perfume stuff too. There are a lot of like Instagram accounts of like well-funded libtard girls with like photographer friends pairing perfume and media. Not that I'm the only person that's ever thought of that, but it is in a very specific way. But yeah, I mean, I just try to keep my heart pure and keep doing it. And fortunately, you know, as much as people try to come up with an imitation of it, they don't have access to the deep grooves of my brain that the deep taste making grooves. So they can't select stuff that has the bombshell effect that things that I select do. So
What's a newer perfume that you've come across that you really liked before we move on to the books?
A newer one?
Yeah.
This. It's an Italian perfume by Meo Fiuccioni called Odor 93. I got it yesterday, and it's inspired by the music of Current 93, a neo-folk band that I very much like. And usually if I see a niche perfume that's like, I was inspired by this and that, that has nothing to do with the person, I'm like, I don't care. Cause there's lots of that, where it's like, this is inspired by The Shining, who cares? But this was just such a specific synchronicity. I'd been like listening to a bunch of Current 93, that week. And then, one of my friends recommended a certain perfume from this brand, and I looked and saw that they had like a Current 93 themed perfume that had been endorsed by David Tibet.
So what is it, like a woody sort of scent? Or
yeah, it's kind of a like woody chypre, smells sort of 70s, has a big narcissus, tuberose, floral note, woody, resinous, heavy, and floral. Just a strange, unexpectedly 70s perfume.
Lovely. Like you're traipsing through the forest or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very woodland magic.
Okay, Valley of the Dolls. So let's talk about Valley of the Dolls. I first came across this as a concept when I saw this really old... It's not really old. It's an older kind of Bette Midler movie that's based on Jacqueline Suzanne's life. I don't know if you've seen that. It's called...
Isn't She Great?
I remember,
like, it's very made for TV.
I remember
liking it.
And I was looking it up before, and I swear I remember that Diane Keaton was in it, because I was like, but I guess I must have just misremembered that from that other movie that she's in with Bette Midler, is The First Wives Club. Is she in that? Yeah, yeah. But she's not. I looked it up and I just remember, and I may be misremembering this image too. I just remember Bette Midler screaming in a pond and like just being very taken with this image and this kind of idea of this over the top woman by the name of Jacqueline Suzanne. And I think that film itself is not exactly like a truthful adaptation of her life, but it was fun enough. And then sort of I looked into Jacqueline Suzanne and saw the movie, but only recently read the book for this, basically. And it's great. And this is one of those kind of books where its reputation precedes it, but its reputation seems very wrong to me. And there's so many of these, which is like, you know, it was sort of like lambasted when it first came out. It's poorly written. And it's really kind of this snobby kind of approach to fiction. But it's amazing. Like, it's actually the idea that this is poorly written is completely outrageous, because there is so much life and wit in this book. And I was like laughing almost every page. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, it's like lines and like constantly. So it really like the writing really crackles and the story's amazing. So I don't really get where this kind of critical appraisal of it comes from, but perhaps very similar to the Rand stuff that we were talking about before, which is that it has this reputation that kind of precedes it and then shapes everyone's thoughts about it. So, yeah, when did you first come across the book?
Well, I can answer your question about its critical reputation. These kind of things that are thought of, these blockbuster books that are thought of as like so bad it's good or so poorly written from many decades ago, including my favorite Scruples by Judith Krantz, who's obviously a descendant of Jackie Suzanne. The critique that it's so bad it's good or it's trash is something from a world that no longer exists, but which people mindlessly repeat as if we still live in a world where adults are reading literary fiction and Norman Mailer and William F. Buckley are on the TV. And there's this casual familiarity with, you know, like people are reading like John Updike. That world existed at one point in the 50s and 60s and 70s. It doesn't exist anymore. So, but
yeah, it's not like people are at dinner parties being like, well, Jackie Suzanne, she's no John Cheever. Or it's not like people are like talking like that anymore. They don't even know who these people are.
They don't know who any of these people are. The entire world of literary fiction, highbrow fiction of that type, is completely lost. Adults approaching 40, the last books that they read were Harry Potter or Twilight. And we're still pretending that something like Valley of the Dolls or Scruples is a guilty pleasure with this like critique made up literally half a century ago. And when you actually read these books, you can't believe how sophisticated and witty and well-written they are. Yet the types of people who write about them, which is usually kind of like libtard librarian type women with blogs, if anyone's interested in this, they'll still refer to them as like trash. Like there's an element of like, I know what they're saying. Like they're like lurid books that functioned as pornography in a certain way. But this is why I encourage people to read fiction so much and like contemporary fiction from decades ago, because it's so much more sophisticated than anything which is called literary fiction, which is released today, which is all this very narrow, like first person, my millennial experience nonsense. And then you pick up something that everyone would have read in an airport in the 80s. And it's like, oh, this spans history and it's so like ambitious. And this is just called trash. So yeah, it's the critique is just an old inaccurate thing that doesn't apply to the world we live in now. And you see, if you watch those interviews with Jackie Suzanne, there's one that I particularly liked that someone sent to me where she's talking to some other woman, I think some like feminist of the time, who's like really insulting her and being like, this is just so lowbrow. It's like, those people don't fucking exist. He's like, snippy public intellectuals that come on TV and talk about ideas, like what world is this? But at the time, Jackie Suzanne had this like very Joan Rivers type like Jewish wit, and her brazen techniques in selling this book and just being like loud and wearing colorful Pucci clothing on TV and everything and not giving a fuck. It was a very new thing, and the like cloistered intellectual types were very taken aback and kind of offended by it, and were very dismissive of it. But when did I first read Valley of the Dolls? I think there was kind of a Valley of the Dolls renaissance in the 90s, where you heard about it a lot. There was a TV show, which I never saw, in about 1995. It was re-released on video, so it was around. I like heard about it as some sort of camp classic, probably in fifth, sixth grade, from my older sister. It was honestly one of the first like adult books that I read, probably in seventh grade. I read all of them. I read Once Is Not Enough, The Love Machine, and this. and loved them all. I was young enough to wear, I don't think they seemed funny to me. They just seemed like sexy and adult. And now they seem really witty and funny as I've been rereading them. But yeah, the movie was one of the original like camp cult gay classics. And that's a broad category, which covers so much different territory. Like something like Mommy Dearest, I don't find funny at all. I find Mommy Dearest just terrifying and terrifying and also very well made. I mean, I understand why it seems out there, but I find it really disturbing. And Showgirls is obviously just good and a miracle in every way, and just it's just a masterpiece that's unlike anything else, where everything came together, but it has this funny uncanniness. Kind of like Beyond the Valley of the Dolls a bit. But Valley of the Dolls itself is just kind of a straightforward soap opera 20th Century Fox adaptation of this book, with, I guess it seems campy because, you know, the lines are like salty and funny, like, you know how bitchy fags can be. And some of the acting is spotty, and Patty Duke is weird. But having seen a lot of movies of this type and being into soap opera and melodrama, it doesn't seem like that out there to me. It was like a big success. It has a lot of connections to its precursor in the sensation novel, Peyton Place by Grace Metalius, another of my favorites, and Mark Robson, who directed
it. Yeah.
The Peyton Place movie, directed that, and Barbara Parkins, who plays Anne, was on the Peyton Place TV show. But I mean, it's just a classic. It's immortal. It has the wonderful, dreary Dionne Warwick song by
which Dori plays Previn every 5 minutes.
Yeah, who doesn't think of that? Who doesn't think of that all the time when you're like on the skids?
Yeah. Dionne Warwick does have a beautiful voice, though, so I wasn't mad. I loved in the movie, I guess we're sort of talking about the book and the movie interchangeably, but they're fairly similar. It's a pretty good, faithful adaptation. But the movie is really funny. Patty Duke is really funny when I think is it Lion or one of the men, I can't remember who, is like grabbing her and like grabs her face and is like, "You look all puffy." And like Patty Duke does look puffy. She gets puffier as the movie goes on. It's like this meta narrative sort of situation going on.
I love Patty Duke. Patty Duke is just a really depressing phenomenon. Because she was a child actor, the won an Oscar for playing Helen Keller. But I read her book called Call Me Anna, where she says she was basically like sold into child actor slavery. Like her parents just gave to this like agent couple, and they just, you know, made her into a star, much like Judy Garland. And then she was on the Patty Duke show, where she played identical cousins, and it was all fun and cute, and she was still like young enough to be cute. And then she like the child actor's curse of just aging into a weird looking adult. And so she did all these flops. Well, this wasn't a flop. It was successful. But stuff like the made-for-TV sequel to Rosemary's Baby, episodes of Police Woman. She just always has a very dreary and depressing energy.
It's funny like that you mentioned the connection to Showgirls, because I got that as well on this watch of the film. Like I got a kind of – there was a Showgirls connection, because Patty Duke is almost – kind of like Elizabeth Berkley, in that like she took on this role because she wanted to mature into something more adult. And that's what Elizabeth Berkley was doing after like being in, was it Saved by the Bell she was in before Showgirls, and that sort of like Disney Channel stuff, right? And I feel like it's the same kind of energy going into the film, like, oh, okay, I'm gonna step my pussy up, to use terrible drag speak.
Shedding your good girl image is something that's been going on, you know, since the beginning of time. Yeah, this is one of the first.
And it has the same sort of like reception that people have to, like, people people did not respond to it well. Like, people were like, oh, Patty Duke's weird and strange and gross in this film. And people said similar things about Elizabeth Berkley. They were like, oh, what's she doing? Blah, blah, blah. She's fantastic in Showgirls, as far as I'm
concerned. Yeah, she's incredible. She gives it her all.
Yeah.
It's something, Showgirls is something that didn't make sense in the world of 1996 when things like erotic thrillers were becoming very unfashionable. So it was kind of from a slightly prior era. And Valley of the Dolls is the same way, because they were counting on this to be a serious, dramatic kind of star vehicle. And, you know, Patty Duke is giving this, she's an Oscar winner. She's giving this movie is full of Oscar winners. Susan Hayward was an Oscar winner too. And she's giving this, you know, really dramatic performance. But the movie itself, coming in 1967 and intended to be shocking, feels like something that would have been shocking in about 1959 or 60. But X-rated movies, Midnight Cowboy is just around the corner. You know, the next year, Rosemary's Baby is just around the corner. Clockwork Orange is just around the corner. So people seeing this in 1967, it would seem like really dated. And, you know, so much changed in cinema from 1960 to 1970. When you think of how they were making just these old big musicals and like Bible movies up at that point, and then for something in 1969 like Midnight Cowboy to win Best Picture only 9 years later, like, that's an insane transformation. But this is one of those movies, another one like this, that just is clearly from an earlier era and seemed very weird, is the first Airport movie, which is, I think, did Mark Robson also direct that? I think he might have.
I'm not sure.
It feels like something from 1960. All the, you know, this book being written by an older woman whose experience of show business was all stuff in like the 40s and 50s. It's just a totally different world of these like ballrooms and this weird Vegas style show that Helen Lawson does. And
in New York.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, like rock music was happening at this point. It just feels, so that's why it seemed really campy to people, because it's just something from a different era, but it's positioning itself as being like edgy and quasi pornographic.
Yeah. There's a few movies like that, that are often considered like camp / Q word classics. Yeah. Like Myra Breckinridge is another one of those, like where you get in the old star, you've got Mae West in it. And it's kind of like, it's got that same sort of vibe as Valley of the Dolls, where like there's musical numbers, but then there's like, you know, dirty, like titty sort of stuff, like nudie stuff that they're kind of gesturing towards, or in fact, in Myra Breckinridge actually showing. But it's that crossover of that old Hollywood style and then like the production code being lifted. And I think the Valley of the Dolls has that same, although not to the same extent, but it has that same kind of like, this is a liminal space, so to speak, between those two eras, right?
And I was going to bring up Myra Breckinridge, actually, because Myra Breckinridge and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls were the two bizarro X-rated out there movies that, I forgot what the, Richard Zanuck, who was the then head of Fox, just kind of gave them carte blanche to do whatever to try to capture a counterculture audience. And Beyond the Valley of the Dolls was really successful, but Myra Breckinridge, which is really similar and came out like, I think, a week apart, has always been regarded as one of the worst movies ever made. I think it's pretty good, and I like the book, but it's those two movies are only 3 years away from this
It's bizarre, isn't it?
The '50s.
Yeah, it's so strange. But like those two movies also still have that kind of '50s. The way they're made is very studio. Like even though it's engaging with all this like countercultural stuff, you can see a certain amount of quality there with the way that it's like it's been filmed and stuff. But anyway, like to give a sort of short plot summary on the book/movie, it's basically about three main characters, women in the entertainment industry. And there's Anne, who's sort of like she's kind of like an ingenue who comes and like becomes a secretary for an entertainment. Is he an entertainment lawyer or is it?
He's a man in a something. Suit that does something.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
The man, they're all just men are all just interchangeable, people in suits.
They pretty much are.
They're either fags or not.
Yes. And then there's Neely O'Hara, who Patty Duke plays in the film, who is like this young up and coming singer. And then there's the old battle axe, who is Helen Lawson, who's like one of my favorite characters. I love her so much.
Yeah.
She's sort of like pretty much every like grand dame drag queen has basically lifted their entire persona from Helen Lawson. Like that's where they get it from. It's like,
yeah, now at like the 10th remove where they have no idea who Helen Lawson is or what Valley of the Dolls is or who Ethel Merman is, but they're imitating someone from Drag Race who's imitating someone from the 90s who Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. But the important thing about Neely, who is like Judy Garland, is that they keep emphasizing how ugly she is, but how talented she is. And that's one of the great things about Jackie Suzanne's writing is she is ruthless about women's appearance as like a predetermining thing like that determines their entire fate. So like in The Love Machine, there's this like kind of fat girl who they describe every time they show her as an ugly as having an ugly face, but like huge boobs, and she becomes like a groupie who like aggressively fucks all the men. But yeah, every single time you see a female character in these books, it says whether she's ugly or whether she's beautiful, and you can never change that. So Neely being ugly but preternaturally talented is essential to her myth, because that was essential to the Judy Garland myth, even though Judy Garland was cute.
Yeah, but, she was cute.
Like, you know, but that was like the thing at the time. Everyone just think, I can't believe how ugly she is.
Yeah.
But, well, with that voice.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that actually reminds me of, remember Susan Boyle? How the entire world was so shocked that some fat woman could sing. Like
that was
as
like
if
2008.
Yeah.
As if this just like a different world.
As if this was this has never happened before in the history of humanity. Someone who is not thin, who can sing, you know? It's
this woman who's about 45 years old and hasn't dyed her hair and has weird eyebrows and is about 30 pounds of her weight. It's an incredible, just that's that 2000s early reality show political incorrectness. It was so amazing.
Love it. See, early reality as well is another thing, like the cruelty of it. It was delicious, like, you know?
The cruelty of it, but think of how much Susan Boyle won. Like now, if she came on a show, it wouldn't mean anything because people are so trained out of having an honest reaction publicly to anyone's appearance. But then to have the whole audience, just, you know, these 2000s people all wearing whale tail thongs, you know, dressed like Britney Spears, being like, who is this old bitch? And then she just bursts out. The whole world was united about it. The whole world couldn't believe that this 45-year-old unattractive woman could sing this song from Cats or whatever.
And then we have the other main character in Valley of the Dolls, which is Jennifer, who is probably the opposite of Neely in that she is she's the most beautiful, and ends up doing like quote unquote foreign films by the end of it, like, which is
where she shows side boob.
But And she, I think it's Jennifer as well, who has the like lesbian affair with.
Yeah, she's like the cautionary tale who everything bad happens to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's Jackie Suzanne punishing the most the beautiful blonde one.
Yeah.
Jackie Suzanne as the Jew, as the Neely O'Hara punishing the. Punishing the Sharon Tate one. So she's the one who like has the abortion and the lesbian thing. And
the lesbian thing was like, that was a beautiful sequence. It was just like, oh, that's so, it was so like tender and nice, you know? And, but then she ends up punishing this woman. But, yeah, I really liked that. Like I was just, I'm not really into lesbian stuff in general. But
well, it's like quaint. Fun. It's just like from another era now because they don't exist anymore because they were genocided by the trans ideology. And now they all think they're men. But I love that early, that 60s, 70s, early lesbian representation where it's like the slightly sinister flute music and the vampiric kind of tweaking of the breasts. Like the killing of Sister George. Yeah, you see the vampiric lesbianism in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. It's always doomed to, which, you know, spot the lie. But it's, yeah, I love that just the tweaking. It's like trying to imagine what lesbians do, and it's just this kind of like a cold hand
tuning a radio or something. And so basically, what you don't realize, you're reading this and it's really funny and witty. It's all about the entertainment industry. The novel is set in 1945. The movie is sort of, they kind of push it a bit later, like just make it all set basically in contemporary times, I think.
It's set in like 1 month.
But whereas this is a sweeping kind of epic. It goes, starts at, I think the war is still going. It's 1945. And then it kind of ends in like the 60s or something, doesn't it? Or just at the edge of the 60s.
Yeah, it ends just at the edge of the 60s, I think.
Yeah. And, but the thing is, you read half of this book and it's just like an entertaining, there's romance, there's sex, there's lesbian sex, there's like lots of faggots being thrown around, but you don't see that many. But lots of people are called faggots, which is great.
And they're not like, you don't feel sorry for them, and they're not like noble assistants or whatever. They're like a contaminant, that they're like a hazard of the industry that will like ruin you.
At least I didn't marry a faggot.
As an unattractive woman in show business, at risk of marrying a bisexual man, you will be ruined and your womanhood permanently thrown into question by this. And, you know, it's just very realistic about all this. And then there's the one guy who's retarded. And that's great. Like, that, I love the depiction of that. In the movie where he's just like a retarded Dean Martin, but the sister Lee Grant, who was very, was also in Peyton Place, has very vampiric lesbian energy, is just covering for him. So no one knows he's retarded.
And then he just randomly falls down one day. And that's when Sharon Tate realizes that.
Falls down of retardation.
But, so you're reading this book. And you get about until the middle of it. And it's not, I don't think, until the middle of it that you realize that this is a rock bottom book. Like, this is about the perils of, like, drugs in the entertainment industry. It is about the entertainment industry, but it's all about, like, coping with things through drugs. And dolls is a old slang word for pills, because all of these women characters end up being, like, trashing themselves and their careers by taking pills. And it's often kind of, people say that it's a roman, a clef, which is a book which is the characters are based on real people that, you know, she's just renamed. That is obviously clear. If you know anything about the American entertainment business at the time, like, Helen Lawson is Ethel Merman and Neely is obviously Judy Garland, like you said. And that is really fun too, like trying to work out who's who, as you're reading it. But yeah, it is about like drug addiction. It's a rock bottom book by the end of it. Like, and I found that I was like really taken aback by that, because even though it's got pills and shit on the cover, I was just, that's just a sort of like, that's a it, like window dressing, but it's not. It's like a crucial part of it. It's all about you know, coping with substances.
Yeah, which is true, because once you enter the entertainment industry and have some success and start like getting actually thirsty, you of course start self-medicating in this way. Like almost no one doesn't. But yeah, I was thinking about in regard to the pills, how pertinent it is to today, with literally everyone being on Adderall, mm-hmm. which was originally a 60s diet pill called Obitrol.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was called Obitrol. And the difference then was that I think it had like more meth in it or something. You know, those pills were really good then. But yeah, they they all get into these unhappy entertainment industry marriages and start taking pills and drinking. And it's illustrated really well in the movie with the giant Patty Duke reaching towards the giant bottles of like jelly bean looking red pills.
And then like collapsing at the beach.
Mm-hmm.
As with like the song a wave
playing.
Yeah. With the
song. Yeah. And yeah. And Anne's like the one you're supposed to relate to.
Mm.
And the other two are cautionary tales. So Anne just kind of like starts taking pills out of boredom and then just kind of has a little collapse at the beach while the song plays, but she's able to recover.
Yeah, that's literally like 5 minutes of the movie. She's like, I'm going to take some pills now. And then, oh, no, I'm not.
Yeah, which is great. I love that classic soap opera substance use where they just do it for a minute and then recover. It's also like funny that this is focused on such a like antiquated type of drug, like a respectable kind of housewife drug, being in 1967 when people are starting to get really scared of pot and LSD. Mm. But this is just about pills. Women always just be taking pills.
Well, so many people, like, you know, you barbiturates were a big thing as well. I don't even know what a barbiturate is, but I know that lots of like old Hollywood people, like, I think that's what Judy Garland was addicted to, one of the things she was addicted to.
Yeah,
but yeah, and like she was sort of, I feel like there's a sly kind of perspective there from Jacqueline Suzanne writing this in the middle of the 60s, or at least publishing it in the middle of the 60s, and being like, you know, all of these stars that people worship are actually just as fucked up on drugs as like the hippies smoking the wacky tobacco, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was a smart synchronicity because drugs at that point were just being kind of promoted as mind expansion, all mixed together with social change and all of this. It's nice to have an old fashioned cautionary tale about how they're bad. And this is, of course, another reason why this is viewed as campy, because anything that shows people like realistically suffering from alcoholism or addiction or anything without just being like glib and like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia gets mocked by like alcoholic gays and young people. So
Yes, definitely. One of the things that's really great about this story as well is how the novel, obviously, nearly, as we mentioned before, is kind of based on Judy Garland. And then initially in the film, Judy Garland was cast as Helen Lawson. So there's a nice little synchronicity there. Did you know about that?
I did know about that.
Yeah. Like, and it's so like, it's a perfect background to the making of the film, because it's like a storyline from Valley of the Dolls, right? Because Judy Garland at this point, it's towards the end of her life, I think. She died in 69, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was 67, I think they were filming it. And she was really frail, really skinny, addicted to whatever the fuck she was addicted to, and just really
everything,
just really erratic, and basically became the older version of Neely, which is the character that is based on her, even though she was playing Helen Lawson in the film. And it caused this major kind of scene. And she went to the papers and said she got fired, basically. I think it's the only film she was fired from. And then it fucked up production. And then they got Susan Hayward in to replace her, who was apparently a joy to work with.
I have to take this opportunity to correct some of the weepy narrative and cliches about Judy Garland. I think people just receive this idea that, oh, old Hollywood was bad. The studio system was bad. They told her she was ugly and put her on speed. Louis B. Mayer molested her, and that gave her an excuse to be an insane drunk for the rest of her life. It's like, no, the studio helped her. Like, this idea that those old studio heads were so evil, you know, molestation notwithstanding, that they were so evil. Like, the studios were like a college campus. They, like, protected the stars. They educated them. They kept them healthy. They gave them reliable work that they didn't have to do anything for. It didn't matter if their movies were successful or tanked. They still made, like, 7 a year.
Sham marriages for the gays.
They covered up your personal life. They mm-hmm. knew that you were gay and created fake tabloid relationships, beard relationships for you to send across the country, because people that were not in Los Angeles and New York would not understand your perverted personal life at that time. Mm-hmm. They protected them. And Judy Garland was someone like Anna Nicole Smith, where, you know, supremely talented, like, glittering image icon, but this is a woman that no one could help. Mm. So, like, you can't imagine anyone telling Anna Nicole Smith what to do. Mm. No one could. Imagine someone telling Judy Garland what to do. No one could. She was completely crazy, and it wasn't just because they put plastic discs in her nose in Wizard of Oz and told her she was fat and gave her Adderall. Okay. Like, they still do that today. They're just word it in a different way. But that kind of, like, weepy narrative about her has been getting to me lately, because there was that recent, like, viral thing about with Judy Garland and blackface and something. And I kept seeing, like, idiots recirculating this. But the studio ruined her. Mm-hmm. It's such a lame, like, these Zoomers just, like, watch fucking Mulholland Drive and just think everything is just old Hollywood chewing people up and spitting them out. No, so many of those people live to be like 90. But whatever, it's just
older. Sorry. Didn't Olivia de Havilland last until like 100?
Olivia de Havilland died like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. She was like 112. Like
103. She was the last one of them. It's, but yeah, Judy Garland was a crazy drunk that you couldn't do anything. And she had a weird thing for gay men because her father was gay. And so she, you know, everyone knows the relationship between, like, hatchet-faced, talented women and homosexuals. And, you know, she just kept repeating her relationship with her father and her marriages.
And then it repeated into the next generation, too, with
Liza. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I saw the video of, like, her wedding, and it was, oh, dear. I don't like to say cringe too much anymore, because it's an overused term, but oof, it was cringe.
Of Liza's wedding?
Yeah.
To David Guest?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
Like, where they were expressing their love for each other.
Was, like, wiped. Didn't they have a reality show that was, like, wiped from history, like so many of those?
Did they? That's interesting.
I think it was one of those early attempts, but yeah, he was a really scary one.
Mm.
But he looked like her gay father. So
yeah. And she's still kicking, so maybe she's learned something from
still
her.
Still around. She looks exactly the same, acts exactly the same. She's a success story.
All right. So, yeah. So, interesting production on the movie too. So we had that Judy Garland thing happen, it was just like such a synchronicity that that happened. And so basically she went off, got fired, and they got Susan Hayward in. Susan Hayward is amazing in this movie. Like it was weird because when I first, cause I didn't remember that she played Helen Lawson. And then when I was kind of, revisiting the movie, I was like, I couldn't really remember her performance, but her performance is really great. Like watching it as an adult now, it's just like, she's so great. She's so
good. So true. Oh, I just remembered another reason this movie is considered bad. It's because the songs are really bad. Aside from the Dionne Warwick one, which is it's the like in movie songs, like the It's Impossible. That like the songs are just
the one she sings. The one she sings in like that cellophane, like mobile, like
yeah, weird.
Let the tree grow, like.
Yeah, let your tree grow. She's singing it as the mobile is going around her face. And this is where snatching people's wigs came from.
Yes, the original and the best, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a great scene where, Neely snatches, what's her name? Helen's wig, and then drops it in the toilet. That's where the camp kind of reading comes in, right? Like snatching women's wigs. And yeah. I didn't really get what the problem was. Maybe it was just my copy of the film. I watched the one that was uploaded to YouTube. And is her hair supposed to be gray? Cause it looks blonde to me.
Her hair is like short and gray.
Yeah. It looked blonde to me on my copy. So I was like, what's the problem?
We're also viewing this after so many layers of woke propaganda have problematized many of the things which are funny in this, which no one would have given a thought to until several years ago. Depicting wigs as frightening is off limits now because black women wear wigs and like fry their hair and go bald. So you can't wig shame, which, you know, and if you're a woman that has to wear a wig, I understand that must be hard. But there's that. And also with so many years of like the Jezebel generation of millennial feminism, we've all learned that it's wrong to show women catfighting. So that's why in current movies you have women just being blandly supportive of each other, and they have to painstakingly write a scene where they're talking about something other than men in order to pass that made up retarded thing called the Bechdel test, which people collectively pretend is real or that anyone should care about. But you'll have in all modern shitty movies a scene of women being like, did you know that I'm into records? And the other one's like, I'm into records too. What's your favorite? So, you know, feminism has triumphed.
Yeah, but that's funny.
Yeah, too. Everything so Valley of the Dolls is problematic.
Yeah, because it's like, I think Valley of the Dolls is... because it tells the truth about women. Like a lot of gay stuff and stuff that gay men love is accused of gay misogyny, right? We spoke about this on your episode that I did on your podcast. But to me, it's just most of what's classified as gay misogyny is just telling the truth about women because like we are able to because we're not trying to get in their pants.
Because we have their brains.
Yes.
So we have their brains and male bodies. So we understand what it's like to be them.
And also the Bechdel test is so funny to me because it's true that all women talk about is men. You been around women? Like all they talk about is men.
Women be talking about men. I don't like, and there's always the thing whenever like you meet a woman with like an unusual male seeming interest, like, oh, how do you know about this movie from 1972 without anything that girls are typically interested in? And you inevitably find out it's the previous boyfriend that they learned about it from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fair enough. Like we all take things from our relationships. It's all a learning process. Of course, but women
especially, it's like you can clock that from pretty far off.
Yeah. Okay. Did you have anything else that you wanted to say about the film or the book before we move on to the psychedelic spiritual successor?
Well, we didn't talk about Sharon Tate. It obviously historical cachet because it's the only big movie that's famous that Sharon Tate did, and she's photographed amazingly and looks
beautiful,
of course. And they all have that late 60s mod eyeliner where it's like the Sharpie line in the crease, which
just to make the really eyes difficult. Pop.
Yeah. there's some good shooting of like hairspray and perfume commercials in this, which look ridiculous to us now, but those commercials are real. They're like Avon commercials from the 60s that look exactly like that, where it's like a Sharon Tate looking woman wandering through a French garden. So it's with a big aerosol can. So
do you ever wonder when you're watching Sharon Tate in like, she's been in like other smaller roles, but this one especially, because this is where she gets the most sort of screen time. Do you ever wonder where like, whether you're watching it and you're like, oh God, she's so beautiful and she has such a like lovely energy. And you wonder whether, do we just think that because we know that she was brutally murdered? Like, you know what I mean? It's this sort of nostalgic reading kind of back.
Sadness.
Like, yeah.
And all and innocence. And it also like works for the character because she's like the tragically beautiful blonde one who people only value for her appearance
and kills herself because she has to get a mastectomy.
Kills herself because her breasts, whatever, you know. Yeah, there's that kind of like after the fact sadness about her. But I have to confess something which may sound perverse, and it's that as horrible as the Manson murders are and were at that moment, like considering the current state of things, I don't get that disturbed or excited by them, because like every day someone's getting like stabbed by a red-eyed homeless person, and then Democrats come in and say you can't be like mad about it. So I'm like, really? Manson murders? That doesn't sound like uniquely horrible to me, considering what a disaster everything is at the end of history right now, but whatever. She's beautiful.
She is beautiful. And I was just wondering like whether, you know, that hanging over, you know, what we know about what happens to her, like shapes the way that we view her. But it's really eerie, this film as well, because the way that all the characters end up is what happened to the actresses. Like,
yeah.
Sort of like, Anne ends up sort of like leaving behind the entertainment business, which is what the actor did. What was her name? The one who played Anne?
Barbara Parkins.
Yeah. And she ended up quitting acting or something, or going into something else, I think.
After coming back for like decades of Peyton Place reunion.
Yeah. And then Sharon Tate fucking died. And then like nearly the what's her name? Patty Duke kind of descended into like, you know, manic depressive, like mental health like issues, this in the same way.
She was
that
like
her
bipolar.
Yeah. So yeah, just what eerie kind of resonances with what happened in the actors' actual lives.
Proving that Jackie Suzanne's ruthless physiognomy reading was all true. It's like reading the tea leaves and everyone's appearance.
Amazing. Yes. Yeah. Anything else on Valley of the Dolls before we move on?
No, it's a classic. Everyone should read it. You should ideally read it in about eighth grade, I think.
Mm. But even now, as an adult, I was loving it. Like it, like I said, that it sparkles. It's witty. It's like out loud funny. Like I rarely laugh.
You should
out
read
loud
it as an adult, obviously. But yeah. I think it's nice to get into it when you're still young enough that it seems naughty that it seems like pornography. So it's, but like your parents can't say anything because you're reading a book.
You're reading.
Yeah.
I was actually, it's funny because obviously not all of the sex in the book is in the film because they couldn't do that. But I was, it's interesting how they gave it that same sort of tone. You know, you got that same sort of porny like vibes in certain moments of it, especially when yeah. when Sharon Tate goes to film the quote unquote foreign film.
Yeah, sex invades every aspect of it. And that that foreign film is one in a long line of old pre-70s Hollywood depictions of women falling on the skids into like an environment more luxe and expensive than any that we will ever see. You know, in like Imitation of Life, when the mixed race daughter like leaves the mother and goes to like work at a burlesque show. It's at this like, you know, this incredibly fancy place, fancier than any of us will ever see. And then, you know, like Mildred Pierce, when that daughter goes to become a singer, it's at some like nice bar.
This is probably what like psyoped a lot of like women into OnlyFans or something. These glamorous depictions of like falling into prostitution or something. Like
that. Oh yeah, well it's always a glamorous narrative to fall into prostitution when you don't have to like live it. It's narrative. It's
when you only have to flash fiction. A nipple on OnlyFans. Because
it really does. In the straight world seem to ruin you forever to be a prostitute, and you're like doomed to only be with a certain type of like weird pimp like guy who will accept you because straight people are so funny like that. They're obsessed with like body count.
Strange.
Only now everyone's on OnlyFans and
yeah,
proud of it.
Yeah. I had someone I was having dinner with the other night who was like, oh, maybe I'll do it with my new girlfriend. I'm like, okay, all right.
Oh, hot. Yeah,
I try
to convince all straight men to do it. Why not?
Yeah, why not? All right, so Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is a film released in 1970, and it was written famously by, what's his name, Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert.
The famous film critic. Is this the only film he wrote?
It is.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
And it's a good one. I love it. And it's directed by Russ Meyer. So he of like Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill fame and other movies like that. Titty movies, essentially. Do you a fan of Russ Meyer?
I am. I mean, this is clearly the best one because this is the big budget carte blanche experiment that he would never be allowed to do anything this big ever again. But yeah, I've seen some of them. I've seen Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. I think I've seen Vixen. I learned about him from John Waters' Shock Value, which is where everyone learned about this movie for many years before it was like in the Criterion Collection. They're both in the Criterion Collection now, which I find charming because originally Fox released the first DVD release of them were these like lavish double disc editions released in June 2006, and I bought them from Best Buy that day. I was really excited. But yeah, John Waters is responsible for the continued positive reputation of this because in that book he says it's his favorite movie. And like Showgirls, it's the type of thing that in 1970 wouldn't make as much sense as it eventually did with the passage of time, because now it seems like an absolute masterpiece outside of time. The editing is just like nothing, that
incredible,
insane fast editing, all that, you know, real film, clipping it with scissors, just nuts. And Fox was originally going to do a straightforward sequel to Valley of the Dolls, like they had done for like Return to Peyton Place. And then they decided to try to capture this counterculture, like crazy psychedelic youth money, and just let Roger Ebert and Russ Meyer do whatever they wanted. And it's one of the X-rated movies from that wonderful period in the early 70s when mainstream movies were rated X, and it's maintained that rating, changed to NC-17 in the 90s. It has fantastic music. All the Strawberry Alarm Clock incense peppermints come with the gentle people. It has this artificiality due to it being written as a joke by someone who had no familiarity with California or hippies or anything. And also the reason that it works so well is because all of the actors are playing it straight, and Russ Meyer directed them very seriously, like to the degree that they did not understand whether their lines were supposed to be funny or not. So nothing's funny if you go into it with all the actors knowing it's going to be funny. So
it's all
wouldn't have been funny.
It's all that's true. Yeah, it's all unknowns too, I think, probably to keep the budget down. But like, and it works as well because, you know, the unknowns aren't precious, you know, back when actors weren't precious, and you know, the main girls all get their tits out. It's not a big deal. Like now it would be like intimacy coordinators and contracts and things like that. But
And they all look just, I mean, any woman would dream of being shot to look like this. Because they just look like living, gauzy Playboy spreads.
The man knows how to shoot breasts and women.
Yeah, where they're just like the peachy. Peachy, creamy texture, like it's just a balloon, and everyone's wearing those gauzy see-through tops, and you know, everybody is the kind of tits that just like point out, like, and the hair, I feel like the hair in this is a style that's pretty universally flattering on most chicks, which is the like slightly back teased little volume, kind of curled up at the bottom, long hair. Most of them have bangs, but they all look incredible. I mean, the black one just looks like a black Barbie.
Oh, she looks so great. And her storyline's really funny. We'll get into that later. But
yeah,
I like that you mentioned the editing too, because the editing in this is so impressive. Like a lot of people like made fun of it because it's so, you know, people in this kind of, oh, it's so bad, it's good, people would say the editing is really choppy and shit like that. But I'm like, no, this is what works about it. It's choppy in those party scenes because it gives you a sense of being in one of those really fucking drug fucked parties, right?
Yeah.
You're on something and you're like, this person's saying something, and it's like fucking chaos. And it's amazing. Like it gives you the sense of like being right there.
Part of the magic of this movie is that everything happens so quickly, like so fast that you can't keep up. So just images whirl by. It really washes over you in this very hallucinatory way. And I can understand people at the time not knowing what they were supposed to make of it, because it has that unique tone. Because it doesn't clue the audience in on what it's doing. Like now, after, you know, years of being normalized as a classic and John Waters writing on Russ Meyer for years and all of this, everyone knows how to approach this.
Yeah.
But at the time, it would be like, what am I, the audience, supposed to think of this weird thing? And also, I mean, it was exceedingly not just sexual, but violent. I mean, really violent for a 1970 movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, decapitations. Like, oh, the very first scene as well, when it's kind of like a flash forward, when I forget the main guy's name. Let's call him what he calls himself at the end, Superwoman.
Z-Man,
that's right. Yeah, the Phil Spector kind of stand-in character. He, when he, like, points the gun and, like, you know, she makes her perform fellatio on the gun and then, like, shoots it, and then it, like, there's that sonic match to her singing and screaming. Like, it's so good.
Incredible.
Like, I love it. But yeah, and the party scenes are so fun. Like, you'll just get random characters who just show up in the party and it'll cut away to them and they'll have a whole conversation, then cut back to the main characters. And it's just, yeah, that sense of being located within it is something that it's an experience. And this is something that a lot of movies and media in general don't really encourage anymore. I think I was speaking about this a couple of episodes ago, where people now, audiences or people who go to see a movie or read a book, are like already thinking, once they read the word or see the shot, what I'm supposed to think of this? What's my interpretation of this? Like, it's like, stop that and just, like, let it wash over you, like you said, right? And it's just a weird thing that people just can't do that anymore. But this film doesn't let you. The great thing about this film is that it really disrupts that kind of viewing. Like, you have to experience it.
Yeah. I mean, people are just not mentally equipped now to evaluate anything for themselves and come up with a critique of it that doesn't rely on cues that they're given beforehand. And if people are not sufficiently notified of the tone with which they are supposed to take a new movie, then they cause a stir about it and say that it's a flaw in the movie and that the movie reached out of the screen and raped them. So that's what we saw last year with like Blonde and Tar. It's been so long since anything was expected of a movie going audience, or since people were educated with any kind of capacity for criticism beyond woke red pin underlining, that people think that it's the movie raping them if they have an unexpected response, which they're not warned about. So everyone would hate this if they didn't know if it wasn't being presented to them as a queer cult classic by, you know, whatever curator.
Yeah, but this is one of those movies as well, similar to Valley of the Dolls, where, like, the queer characters are the evil, diseased characters.
Which, like,
Z-Man ends up being a transsexual, I think, like, it's sort of suggested.
Yeah, that's very forward thinking. Mm-hmm. The female to male transsexual thing is something we wouldn't see until way later. But yeah, it's done in this, like, it just, like, one more ridiculous twist kind of way that you see. It's just more of an unexpected twist because you're led to believe the entire time that he's gay, which is already pretty out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the story of this, such that it is like, it's sort of similar. Like I said, it's inspired, I guess, and perhaps commenting on the Valley of the Dolls, in that you have, you know, three women who go somewhere and, like, you know, descend to the depths, and then some of them ascend at the end. And there's lots of drugs, but instead of, like, the entertainment industry in New York, it's they just go to California. And they're in a band, and then they get it run in with this Z-Man, who's like this Phil Spector figure, who, by the way, I think, didn't he, like, murder someone, like a girlfriend or something like that?
Phil Spector, yeah.
But that wasn't found, that wasn't known at the time of this film, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I think he was only
that was in like
2000s,
2000s.
Yeah. So yeah, there's not much of a story other than like, nested stories of all the different characters. So like the black girl has her own story. The main girl has her own story involving like this nebulous idea of a inheritance that's never sort of like, fleshed out, but it's still great. And, what was the third girl? Is she the lesbian one? The third one?
Yeah. Well, they're a girl band. Yeah. So that's what the plot is. They're a girl band that goes,
that goes west. Called
the Carrie Nations.
Yeah.
That goes west. And, they like lip sync to great music. There's all kinds of glittering images in this that I think about all the time. I think about Dolly Reed ordering Thousand Island dressing all the time. With they're at dinner, she's like, Thousand Island.
Wait, is that the main girl?
Yeah, the main one.
What was with her accent? Like, because sometimes it was English and then it was just like American. It was weird to me.
She's just a hot chick with an accent, just,
mid-Atlantic, you know,
in this netherworld. crazy parties, you know, a lot of the kind of aesthetics and spirit of this people are probably more familiar with in the form of Austin Powers. It's satirizing like everything. I mean, it's satirizing the plot of the original movie and making fun of how dated that movie was when it came out, but it utilizes tropes from every kind of media. It has a lot of soap opera contrivances. I especially love the moralistic voiceover narration at the end, which is like,
yes,
Samuel Rich, it's like a 18th century novel type, like Samuel Richardson, like listing all the lessons everyone's learned,
meditations on love and stuff.
I think
like
the media should like unironically have that at the end of everything. It's just so otherworldly and ahead of its time. It's also shot on beautiful widescreen, anamorphic, just looks incredible.
That's what I mean about what we were saying before, like that you have this kind of tawdry subject matter, but it's at that period when it's filmed in a really amazing way. It's not like guerrilla filmmaking that would be in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, right? It's like,
which, Myra Breckinridge is filmed like that too.
Yeah.
And another thing to consider is that revival cinema and the appreciation of old Hollywood movies was only becoming a thing right about the time this came out in the 70s, because before that, no one cared about old movies or old movie stars except gays. There wasn't this kind of like Academy Awards culture of like the 100 greatest movies. Like people just didn't care about that. And then in the late 60s and 70s, like Humphrey Bogart movies and Marx Brothers movies became big popular trippy things at revival theaters for college students. And so Myra Breckinridge and this both have this 60s gay sensibility for the appreciation of old Hollywood and old Hollywood movie tropes. So there's that too.
Yeah. And then I think a lot of that as well, because that kind of thing became a kind of underground part of the underground counterculture. And that's where I think a lot of new Hollywood stuff comes from, that appreciation for the old Hollywood and like remixing it and things like that. What was I going to say about that as well? It slipped my mind. Anyway, but yeah, the I love this film mostly, like I said, because of that. Oh, that's what I was going to say. So both Myra Breckinridge and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls were, you know, the start of the 70s. But they're still very 60s, you know? And this is one of these things. I don't think I'm the first person to say this, which is that the 60s lasted way longer than the actual 60s, you know, like the aesthetic, the feel, all of that stuff, like probably until like the mid 70s, right? At least in movies, like things seemed like they were still in the 60s because it was that hangover of that culture. And I think these are some of the first films in the 70s to have that feel, you know?
Yeah. The previous decade always lasts like half a decade into the next one.
Like the 90s. The 90s were very long.
Yeah. And the 90s had a bunch of different things. Like now when people do their little, you know, like Nylon magazine, like 90s style thing, it's all like grunge, but people were still dressing like it was the 80s until like 1995. And then the like peak kind of like by the time like grunge had really reached mainstream Hollywood projects in the form of stuff like My So-Called Life, it was like 94, 95. And the next thing, which is that kind of like space age, shiny millennial rave aesthetic, was already coming in. But yeah, there's always that delay. There's like one Netherworld period I particularly love is the very early 80s, where it still looks like the 70s, like
everything's brown
and everything's brown, everybody's just wearing sweaters. It's really
the itchy couches with the blankets,
itchy couches, really old lady perms. Yeah, the ordinary people, really de-sexed moment. And yeah, these are both of these movies have that 60s artificiality. The 60s themselves were just an especially varied decade, because you have like the Dean Martin shit, like you see in Valley of the Dolls, which is like 1960-ish, and then you have like what, you know, like Hairspray, like John Waters, like Hairspray, like that kind of thing, very early 60s. You have mods, you have hippies,
rockers.
Yeah, it's but by and large, like most people existing in real life would have still been dressing just like it was the 50s, like through the 70s, like,
yeah, possibly through the 80s as well if they were still alive.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. when I was in like middle school in the early 2000s, I still had like teachers that dressed like 80s power dressing.
Yeah,
like,
same. It's leftover. Amazing. But the other thing I would say as well, like I about like decades, like having a hangover and going into the next decade. The other day at work, I had to write a story on, do you remember Dawson's Creek?
Yeah.
So, and we were debating in the team whether this was a 90s or a 2000s show. And to me, it actually started in 98, right? But to me, it's a 2000s show. It just like reminds me of the early 2000s. And it's very, I think that's when it sort of took off as well. So that's an interesting thing in the reverse, I think. Sometimes something that started in the previous decade becomes more solidified in the next decade.
Right.
What do you think about Dawson's Creek? Do you think it's more 2000s or 90s?
I think it's a very specific period from 1998 to 2000. To me, it's late 90s, because the WB, the channel, was such a big thing. Later it changed into the CW or whatever it is now, but at that time it was like monolithic teen programming. So that's when Buffy, which though half of it was in the 2000s, I still think of it as being peak late 90s.
Mm.
Felicity and Dawson's Creek were all very 1998 to 2000.
If you do an episode on any of those three, I will totally do it because I love all of those shows.
I haven't watched all of Dawson's Creek. Like, I caught a bit of it. I was like a little too young, and my parents, it was like so sexual that my parents didn't really like me watching it. They didn't like me watching Buffy either, but I just like insisted. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the nighttime soaps that I haven't gone through and watched all of it.
Yeah, I don't think I watched all of it either, but I used to I watched every episode when it was on in the 90s, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. I loved like overly verbose teenagers, like just speaking in a way that no one of that age would, like 16-year-olds saying obsequious and stuff like that.
I'm wondering how that will play now. Kevin Williamson, Joss Whedon thing. I know that people are like fanatical about Gilmore Girls, but I've never watched it because it has that willfully like artificial clever kind of writing, but who knows? Maybe it'll
seem good to me now. So fast. I always imagine when I've watched I didn't really watch Gilmore Girls that much, but like I always imagine the scripts of those episodes, they must be like that thick because they're like talking constantly and really fast. It's like they're on.
Yeah, that stresses me out, and I like dialogue and pacing where. Like daytime soaps where nothing happens, everything is repetitive, and I can just like do something else and walk in and out of the room, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's great. That's what soap operas are built for, right?
Yeah, it's unappreciated because now everything is like made with this fast pace and is like all clever, and like it's intended for you to sit and watch it with rapt attention, but everybody's still looking at their phone the whole time while they're watching it. But you know, soaps are deliberately designed to be viewed inattentively while doing housework,
so. And you don't need to rewind like you would on a streaming platform or something like that, because they'll repeat what happened. Yeah, it's great. It's perfect. What else about Beyond the Valley of the Dolls appeals to you, Jack?
I think my favorite thing about it is the editing and how good the girls look.
What about the guys?
The guys are really hot. It's that Rocky Horror kind of.
The one who becomes temporary paraplegic. He's my favorite. I like a darker guy, so
yeah, I love that. I love the paraplegic plot line. It's just like hot how everyone's on drugs and bisexual, and
it's groovy, man. It's the 60s.
Yeah, it's groovy. And now it's very like everybody like having a negative tone about 60s and the hippies is like overplayed, and everybody does it in this like smug, jealous kind of way. Ahead of its time in that way.
My theory on that is that is resentment against boomers. Like, that's what that is. Like, when you have, especially from when it's coming from like a more conservative place, like, you know, 29-year-old conservatives who like hate hippies and all of the culture that they produced, it just comes from a resentment from boomers, I think. And boomers were great. I don't care what people say. Like, I think most boomers were cool. Like,
boomers are amazing. I mean, they're right about everything. It's, they're just resented because they were lucky, because they are the generation that grew up with the most. A prosperous economy and the most privilege. They were just really lucky, and they lived through the best part of the 20th century and all the cool evolutions of pop culture and everything. And they're right about everything. I have been very vocal about the pernicious threat of Gen X, and how Gen X doesn't get blamed nearly enough for creating the dreary, stupid world in which we currently live, where everyone is obsessed with defending the supposed underdog and making Halloween year round, and
everything is fuck you, dad.
Everything is fuck you, dad, and everything is a battle against imaginary evangelical Christians who never existed in the first place. So the Gen Xers are so susceptible to every kind of propaganda. So they're like the pink-haired mothers that have these trans 11-year-olds and all this, because they just are eternally in this like Bart Simpson on a skateboard mindset, where they are doing everything to like piss off imaginary Christians because of all their movie, all their like Tim Burton movies about twisted suburbia. I have a bone to pick with Gen X, and I cannot stop saying negative things about Zoomers. I really need to shut my mouth about that too, but I hold them in such contempt.
I mean, so sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm with you like 90% of the time, and then sometimes I'm like, oh, there's a little bit of promise there, and then I'm always disappointed.
a couple years ago, all the right wing people were like floating this like Zoomers will be based, like Zoomers will free us from that, and look, now I have to receive like malfunctioning, dead-eyed, incompetent customer service from a moon-faced, half-trans Zoomer autism headphones on, who has no problem-solving abilities and thinks that movies can rape them.
And like, the wordless turning around of the iPad for the tip. Like, that doesn't happen here. It happened all the time. When I was in the US, I was just like, why am I tipping? Why would I tip you for this? Like, you're literally behind a counter. And
yeah.
But it's wordless too, like, because they can't communicate. It's just like,
well, they don't have if they had common sense, then they would know that creating an enjoyable experience for everyone and solving problems would actually make their day and their lives easier. But they don't have common sense because their brains are entirely fried from the internet and from
too many dolls.
From their Gen X divorced mother sending them to therapy starting at age 3 and putting them on all these medications. And I just lately, with the way things are going, I just don't feel particularly generous towards them.
I am afraid of growing older and them being in charge, because like, my God.
It would be great if I were in charge. So I'm not worried about that.
No. When Zoomers, everything would be great.
Life would be like beyond the valley of the. When Zoomers, like, yeah, that'll be
when we're terrible. Old and they're running things, it's just going to be awful. Like,
it'll just be like the most insane censorship bureau of all time, and everyone's vaping, and
they'll probably ban Beyond the Valley of Dolls.
They'll ban alcohol, that's them. For sure. Yes. None of them drink because they are on so many mental health and trans medications that you can't combine alcohol with them.
Yeah, it disrupts their endocrine system, or it disrupts their disruption of their endocrine system.
Yeah.
All right. Anything more to say on Beyond the Valley of Dolls, or shall we call it a night?
It's an X-rated, far out classic that everyone should see. Oh, and everyone should start watching old Siskel and Ebert clips. There's a massive playlist of, I think, every episode they ever recorded, like 800 something videos on YouTube. And they're so incredible, and they are camp themselves because they talk like Mary Hardman characters. And I just love Siskel and Ebert so much now.
Is it Siskel or Ebert who has the the has it in for slasher films, or is it both of them?
Both of them do. That's what they're most known for today. And that's really amusing to see them constantly getting hysterical over the depiction of women in horror movies, because we know the direction that things went in the 2010s, which is that horror became the dominant genre for libtards. Who are totally desensitized to all screen violence. While Siskel and Ebert were this older generation of 70s kind of feminist men, where they would like these sex movies like Cat People, but they would find like When a Stranger Calls or like any slasher movie super degrading to women because it shows them in peril and shows them helpless. So that's just one trope of theirs, but you get a much broader view of their amazing talent for movie criticism when you watch everything else.
Yeah, they're so good. I remember that video that went around a while ago, or a few weeks ago actually, with Roger Ebert, like talking about political correctness and stuff like that. And so these things really do go in cycles, don't they? Like,
yeah, because political correctness was gone for a long time. It was a thing of the past for about 20 years, and then it was willfully revived in a new and more pernicious form.
But when it when it came about in the 90s, that's sort of how we got Palia. So
yeah, it's how we got Palia. Yeah. But yeah, not all bad. Those that kind of boomer liberal thought that appreciates free speech and mocks people's fake sensitivities is just, you know, from another world where no one would even understand that now, because it's 2023 and libtards and normies still think the world according to this battle with Trump that they made up and that was planted in their heads and isn't real. So
I think some of them are starting to see that the principle of free speech is worth protecting now due to certain events, which I will not comment on, but and I'm sure you don't want to comment on them either, but you've probably seen this
I know nothing about nothing. Yeah, I think it's funny that they're getting fired
It's bad to fire people for things that they say online. Like, yes, it is.
They're never going to learn. Yeah. They don't. The thing is that they, like, facts and logic won't win the battle against that thing which has infected their brain, because they don't care. I mean, they don't. They still only have one enemy in their head, and it's the media invented one of the domestic white Trump supporting terrorists. So it just, whatever anti-Semitism or racism or whatever, doesn't count if anyone else is doing it. There's nothing will change their mind. They're so brainwashed. I'm not particularly happy when people only now are realizing that something is wrong, now that the whole world and the most prosperous and greatest country that ever existed has been totally ruined due to this poisonous leftist ideology, which no one would stand up against for fear of social stigma. So what do they have to show for it? All of those years of not speaking out or using their own common sense, they can still have lunch with their libtard friends from high school and college, because normies care so much about social relationships and social approval. Whereas I have been publicly speaking out the whole time, and I've lost a lot for it. So, just one thing after another, they never realized anything bad was happening, and now it's all gone.
Yeah. I mean, I think you kind of won, though, because you have a very passionate fan base all over the world listening to your podcast. And your podcast is, it is you speaking out and speaking from the heart and being very honest. So I think you won ultimately.
Yep. I won.
But
Thank you, though. No, that's very, I'm just kidding. I'm being like really arrogant on this one. No one's ever going to listen to my podcast. But
if you do want people to listen to your podcast, where should they go?
To patreon.com/perfumenationalist.
Mm-hmm. If you want to listen to this man talk about perfume media, pair them with his velvety voice, get on over to Patreon to listen to that. I'll list that in the show notes. Thank you, Jack, for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.